I'm really very, very glad to be in Bern. It's really nice to see familiar faces here. And it just occurred to me that this is actually the room where I gave my job talk ages ago. So I'm glad I don't have to give a job talk today and that these times are over. But it was the exact same room. So thanks for your interest. And I should also mention that this is a co-authored paper with a colleague from Zurich University, Holger Baumann. And as you will see, it's very much work in progress. And I therefore look particularly forward to the discussion. So these are the questions I wish to pursue in this talk. Could it be that paternalism is more benign in friendship? And relatedly, are we sometimes morally permitted to paternalistically treat our friends, while a similar kind of interference or intervention, if you like, would be impermissible towards strangers? In short, does friendship, and I take this a bit as a placeholder for close symmetric relationships, does that change, as it were, the deontic status of paternalism, which is usually rotund to wrong and in dire need of justification? Could it be that it doesn't need that kind of justification? It could be even morally required in close relationships such as friendship. I should also flag, when I talk about friendship, I not only take it to be some sort of placeholder for symmetric attitude-dependent relationship between roughly equals, characterized by patterns of interaction and behavior and attitudes. But I don't depart, or we don't depart from a more substantive conceptions of friendship. There's a huge debate on what friendship is. I'm just looking at Richard, who knows that very well because it goes back to antiquity. So I don't subscribe to anything like more substantive or try to stay away from that. Now, the question whether paternalism is morally permissible, perhaps even required, but in any case, morally more benign in friendship, has gained some traction in recent years by a few philosophers, one of whom is George Tsai, who wrote in a paper in 2018, for example, quote, "The closer, more intimate the relationship between the relevant parties, the stronger the overall moral justification for paternalistic intervention," end of quote. Ellen Fox, in an earlier paper, oops, am I now, I think I'm too loud, no?
It's loud enough. It was off before, so now it's
good. Okay, so should I speak like this? Okay, is it? Can you hear me well in the back? And it's not too loud? Okay. But you got the beginning, I hope, acoustically speaking. Yeah, I see. Thank you, Andreas. I wasn't even aware of that. So in an earlier paper, Ellen Fox writes, quote, "Certain kinds of paternalistic interferences are justified by the bonds of friendship and intimacy which connect particular people," end of quote. Now, the following questions may fuel some of these intuitions that underlie those claims. So these are the intuitions in favor of paternalism in friendship. So we might ask, is it permissible to approach a friend for her problematic drinking habits while approaching a stranger in a bar is not? Is it even morally required to interfere with a friend's provocative behavior during a team meeting to protect him from severe consequences for his career? Oops, sorry. Are we allowed to stop a friend from breaking up with his long-term partner after a heated argument on the phone by denying his request to drive him home immediately, see his partner, and terminate the relationship. Some of you, maybe most of you, may think that we should answer these questions to the affirmative. But now consider the following variations of these examples that should fuel some intuitions against paternalism in friendship. Is it less problematic to approach a friend who one knows to be a self-declared lifestyle alcoholic than to approach a stranger? Is it permissible to interfere with a friend's provocative behavior if she has made it clear that she does not appreciate such interferences, no matter what she does? I think I'm moving too much. Die Kappe. Und was tue ich mit der? Andreas, darf ich dich da?
Darf ich?
Du darfst. Oder wir legen es hin. Weil das kommt wahrscheinlich mit meinem Hin- und Hergehen.
Ja,
man steht nicht so ruhig da.
Ich habe sonst eine Jochen auf Hosentasche.
Okay.
Das wird erst eine Weile wieder dauern.
Ja? Ist es? Do you hear me?
Ja, aber es geht dann
an. Oh, okay. So I just talk and then it eventually... Okay. So third question. Is it permissible to interfere with a friend's decision to break up with her partner if there is no reason to question that it is... her, it should be her, autonomous decision, even though one firmly and with good reasons believes that it would be a mistake. I conjecture that many would find such interferences not only morally problematic, but possibly even more so in friendship. So what can we make of such diverging intuitions? Is it true that paternalism can sometimes be more benign, perhaps even morally called for in friendships, while other times it is more problematic, morally speaking? Now, the aim of this talk is to address these questions and outline a more systematic account that helps to make sense of our conflicting intuitions about paternalism and friendship. And as I said, it's work in progress, so I hope you help me. Our claim is that justifications for or against paternalistic interferences in friendship are based upon an interplay of different norms of friendship and the expressive meaning of these interferences. That's our claim. And that different norms of friendship provide distinct and different reasons for and against such interferences. But before I get started and argue for these claims, let me set the stage. So several arguments in the debate have been provided to support the claim that paternalism is generally or typically more benign in friendship. And what is common in these accounts is that they think that friendship plays a distinct and irreducible role in the justification of paternalism. And they reject received views on paternalism, according to which paternalism is always pro tanto wrong, no matter what kind of relationship holds between two parties, and that it always stands in strong need of justification. Because, and there's a whole variety of different theories of paternalism. I'm not going into these. Let me just flag or mention two of them. Typically, people think, you know, paternalistic intervention violates the right to autonomy or the normative authority of persons. And this is what people have said more recently or highlighted more recently, like Nico Cornell and Jonna Schifrin, that it manifests an insulting and disrespectful attitude of distrust in the other party's agential capacities. And that's why paternalism is usually pretend to wrong. And I think that, you know, we find that intuitively quite plausible, one might think. Now, these accounts I mentioned in favor of paternalism in friendship share the view that there are norms that are taken to be constitutive of friendship, like concern for the well-being of one's friend, particular kind of trust, vulnerability, intimacy, that these provide distinct reasons in favor of paternalism. And those who argue that paternalism is more benign in friendship appeal to such norms, or what one could call relationship-dependent reasons for paternalism. And on first inspection, this could be substantiated by what one might call the striking difference in responses to paternalism to strangers and paternalism with regard to our friends. When a stranger would sort of interfere with us, we might be inclined to say, who are you to treat me like this? This is none of your business. And a response to paternalism or lack thereof by our friends might lead us to say, how can you in particular treat me like this? Or how can you not interfere and help me prevent making mistakes? So friends, the thought goes, hold normative expectations that the others step in when they're likely to make a mistake. So on first sight, at least, it seems plausible that friendship does affect the justification of paternalism. And if this is right, it seems natural to think that friends do so invariably, or that paternalism is justified in friendship invariably. But this is precisely what we want to question. So let me highlight that we work with a rather broad definition of paternalism. I said there's a huge debate on what it is, and we don't want to get into this. But let me just mention that we take paternalism to be characterized by the intention to help someone to avoid making mistakes, the belief that the other person is unable to avoid this mistake on her own, the other regarding desire to promote the interests or well-being of the other person for her own sake, and the fact that no previous consent to or agreement with such intervention exists or has been given. So in some sense at least, it occurs against the will, as many say, of the other party. Such paternalistic interventions, bear in mind, sometimes I talk about interference, sometimes more mildly about interventions, because whatever paternalism precisely is, it can come in different guises. So I can sort of aggressively step in and prevent you from doing something, but I can also nudge you into doing something, or I can adamantly advise you to not do something. So we take all these things to be paternalistic in some sense, at least. But it doesn't mean that the freedom proper of the person needs to be restricted. Like when we adamantly advise somebody, the person will still be free to do something else. Now let me now turn to three proposals, unsuccessful in our view, that have been given or presented to ground relationship-dependent reasons for paternalism, who claim that paternalism is sometimes even required, but certainly benign in friendships. Now, the first proposal refers to shared projects and or meshed identities. Again, there is a passage inside where he states this idea. He says, furthering the success of a project that one shares with one's friend, quote, may involve acting in a way that involves circumventing the friend's agency, yet promotes the well-being of both friends, end of quote. So on a related and even more demanding view, if you like, Alan Fox again speaks of friendship that involves the at least partial meshing of identities. Since this meshing of identities manifests itself, quote, in part by the liberties that one friend takes in guiding the life of the other, end of quote, paternalism is justified in friendship. So we think there is already a very obvious objection to these views. And one might think it doesn't even make sense to speak of paternalism, because the aim of the interference is not the well-being, not primarily at least, the well-being of one's friend, but the success of the shared project. And, you know, the reason why one steps in seems much more plausibly to be captured as a reason that primarily matters for the paternalizer's own sake. Why would they otherwise want to rescue that shared project? And relatedly, the aim of interference in the other case, when that is the meshed identities of the respective friends, it seems that the friend's well-being is only a means to that meshed identity, and that again seems to matter primarily for the paternalizer's sake. And again, we think it's much more plausible to assume that it's the friend who interferes who has such a strong interest in maintaining that meshed identity. So as a result, it seems the friend interferes on both accounts, primarily for self-regarding reasons. And that's why the interference or intervention doesn't qualify as paternalistic, if paternalism means you have to, you know, care for the well-being of the other party's own sake. Now, in response to this objection, proponents of such accounts may argue that it is, after all, the well-being of the friend that the interference targets, because it's good for the friend that the project, the shared project, is being rescued. But the problem with this response is that it doesn't seem to be the well-being of the friend per se, even though it might explain to some extent why the interference qualifies as paternalistic, but the fact that the friend's agency is impaired, or the fact that some severe harm ensues for the friend if he or she does not partake in the shared project. Note, if that is the case, that the friend is just is an impaired agent and therefore threatens the shared project, and we step in to prevent them from doing that, it seems like such a justification is not relationship dependent. Why? Because it can also be accepted by anti-paternalists, who usually don't have problems with so-called soft paternalism. That is, they think even though paternalism is pro tanto wrong, it is justified in cases of impaired agency or cases of severe harm that might ensue. Even that goes back to John Stuart Mill, who holds this. Now, a different version of this response may seem more promising. One may raise doubts about the assumed distinction between the I and the we, that the objection, it's not about the well-being of the friend, presupposes. And this is what precisely the meshed identity account claims. It makes no sense, accordingly, to say that the interference is not primarily concerned with the friend's well-being, since the two friends conceive of themselves as one. But the meshed identity account obviously embraces a conception of friendship that is highly contested. It doesn't, for example, allow that friends sometimes care about disengaging from their shared identity, have an identity of their own, don't overlap that much in their identities, and what have you. Furthermore, if we have such a strong conception, it seems that paternalism is built into the notion of friendship. then it is question-begging to even think about whether paternalism is justified in friendship if paternalism is already entailed by a conception of friendship. So this is not what we can want to look for. Now, as a preliminary result, we can state that neither shared projects nor matched identities provide reasons for paternalistic interference, because the interference is based on self-regarding reasons, or paternalism is vindicated because it's assumed that it is good for the friend to interfere, but either on relationship-independent grounds, because there is, it's a case of impaired agency or severe harm, or due to a highly controversial conception of friendship, namely the conception of having meshed identities. There is an alternative explanation that friends could be said to consent to paternalism when starting a project or meshing their identities. But again, that's a relationship-independent explanation, that consent has been given or agreement has been reached, because consent in general waives the right against paternalistic interference independently of the fact that two people are in a close relationship. So in light of this result, let me turn to the second proposal to justify paternalism on account of some feature of friendship that's built into friendship. So some resort to vulnerability and intimacy. So the fact that friendship entails vulnerability is taken to be non-accidentally related to the fact that paternalism is often a requirement of being a good friend, because we open up to each other, thereby making each other vulnerable to, you know, to each other, and to make ourselves vulnerable to being exploited in our trust. Again, George Tsai states such a view when he claims, "We value friendship because we can, quote, relax the default self-protective strategies that we usually have in life. That is, we open ourselves up and make ourselves vulnerable. And since we present ourselves as vulnerable to our friends, paternalism is just the, quote, expression of the kind of intimacy we cherish," end of quote, "and thus morally permissible." And Ellen Fox has this nice quote in a similar vein when she maintains, "Intimacy without kibitzing is hardly intimacy at all." One might say what this second proposal seems to get right is that we may know better what our friends really need and what their weaknesses are. We certainly have better, usually at least, epistemic and emotional access to our friends' perspectives. And then, therefore, we also usually know better when their agency is impaired or when their decisions are likely to have a negative impact on them. And it is such considerations that provide reasons for paternalism. But note that these reasons do not ultimately derive, oops, from our friend's vulnerability or our intimacy, but again from some relationship-independent considerations, namely impaired agency or harm. We just have better access to our friends because they made themselves vulnerable to us. So we know, you know, that's a kind of case where our friend might have a hard time making good decisions. Yeah, but that's only causally relevant. But it's not the friendship per se that grounds paternalism. We would have this exact same reason for paternalistic interference in the case of a stranger, for example, if we overheard a conversation that somebody is likely to severely harm themselves. We might have a similar reason to interfere, even though there is no relationship at all in place. So it's only because intimacy typically provides us with better epistemic access to the relevant information that grounds reason to interfere, but it's not the relationship per se or the intimate relationship per se. One could think of another alternative reading, according to which one might say, by sharing intimate details, we invite paternalism in the sense of requesting help or consenting to be supported in making our decisions. But again, if that's an interesting reading, paternalism seems more permissible due to the fact that implicit or explicit consent has been given. And that holds true in the case between strangers as well. So Tsai and Fox admittedly hold the view that we can only realize intimacy if paternalistic interferences are involved. But that's a strange kind of concept of intimacy, that it entails paternalism. There's a very recent paper that is forthcoming in the Journal of Philosophy by Jasmine Gunkel on intimacy. And she has a very interesting account of intimacy where she claims intimacy accounts for hidden and important features of persons. They are hidden in that they're not desired to be shared with the general public. And they are important as they are connected to the person's identity. I'm sure that this is a contested proposal about what intimacy amounts to, but it's a very plausible conception, and there is nothing in that conception that suggests that paternalism is necessary for intimacy to be realized. On the contrary, we think, one might even claim that we often have respect-based reasons to abstain from paternalistic interferences, because otherwise, if we paternalistically interfere, our friend might shy away from us because they no longer feel safe and respected. And we exacerbate their vulnerability by stepping in and thereby disrespecting them. As a result, and on the one hand, vulnerability and intimacy play a role in the justification of paternalism, but only because they provide better epistemic access to relationship-independent reasons for paternalism, such as severe harm and impaired agency. On the other hand, vulnerability and intimacy can also provide reasons to refrain from paternalism to secure and maintain respect, because it takes respect to not exacerbate the vulnerability that is typical for friendship. So far, none of these proposals yield the kinds of reasons we are looking for, namely relationship-dependent reasons to justify paternalism in friendship. So lastly, let me look at the perhaps most straightforward proposal to explain why paternalism might be more benign in friendship, and that resorts to beneficence. It appeals to the robust concern for the well-being of friends that is constitutive of friendship. And therefore, one might claim we have stronger reasons of beneficence in an intimate relationship, which can ultimately come down to some kind of paternalism because, when we care for the well-being of our friends, we sometimes have reasons to step in and interfere. Now, David Enoch gives voice to this view in some way, at least, when he writes, but she, my wife, is also under special obligation compared to strangers to promote my well-being. This is why, whatever you may think about her hiding the candy, surely you think it would be much more morally objectionable for a distant colleague of mine to do so. Now, we readily accept the idea that friends have stronger reasons to care for each other and should be more concerned about each other's well-being than that of strangers. But it doesn't follow that beneficence makes paternalism and friendship more benign. To begin with, a doctor also has stronger reasons of beneficence toward a patient But paternalism would disrespect the patient's autonomous agency. I mean, the whole sort of contemporary medical ethics is built on this. Why should friendships be different in this regard to doctor-patient relationships unless they consent? And that, as I tried to point out, it seems that there are also reasons of respect that can be even stronger in friendship, precisely because you're friends. For example, you might react much more strongly to your partner signing you up to a fitness center because it would be good for you, compared to your doctor signing you up for the same reason. So I'm curious what you're going to say. So this discussion demonstrates, we hope, that friendships are governed by different and potentially conflicting norms, most notably norms of care and norms of respect for our friends. In some cases, these norms do not conflict because the agency of our friend is impaired and we have stronger reasons to interfere, usually because we have better access to the friend's impaired agency. And in other cases, the friend's agency is not impaired, and it needs to be assessed whether reasons of beneficence should outweigh the norm of respect. And we think that's a very tricky business. So as a result of this discussion, let me highlight three challenges for a relationship-dependent account of paternalism that we're looking for. It must show that cases of interference in friendships are cases of paternalism. So it must be the well-being of the friend that matters, not my own interests. So whatever intervention it is, it must be done with an eye and for the sake of one's friend's well-being, for the friend's own sake. It must also show that the presumed justification of paternalism does not ultimately derive from relationship-independent considerations like impaired agency, severe harm, consent or agreement. And it must work with a plausible conception of friendship that does not one-sidedly emphasize one norm or rest on a very debatable conception of friendship, such as the meshed identity conception. And that's very tricky to find room for this. So this brings me to consider cases when paternalism is more problematic in friendship. And our strategy is guided by the following idea. Once we have identified those features of friendship that render paternalism with regard to our friends more problematic, maybe we are in a better position to identify those cases in which paternalism might be less problematic or even called for. So let me go back to the examples I mentioned at the outset. For example, interfering with a friend, let's call her Anne, who one knows to be a self-declared lifestyle alcoholic. The interfering friend, let's call him Paul, thereby expresses in some sense that he does not value Anne's way of life, being a self-declared lifestyle alcoholic. It is a kind of strange way of life, if you like. But that's a case of disrespect. In the case of a stranger, Paul's interference is objectionable because it is disrespectful. Paul is not entitled to hold any belief that the stranger is unable to direct his or her life and requires interference. In the case of Anne, Paul may have some reasons for such a belief, but either Anne's agency is really impaired and she's somehow out of her mind, or, and that seems to be more the case in the given example, that these reasons for paternalism are actually outweighed by the norm that friends should respect each other for who they are, even though they might not always share their respective conception of a good life. So even a lifestyle alcoholic, even if I don't think that's a great conception of leading a good life, requires respect if this is what my friend is and does. So, and it seems that respect for our friends is incompatible with any form of hard paternalism that is defined by imposing our values on our friends' values. So as long as Paul regards himself as Anne's friend, one might say, his paternalism, if he really stepped in and tried to prevent her from being a lifestyle alcoholic, tries to talk her out of it all the time, is disrespectful in a relationship-dependent way. That's not what friends do, one might think, and derived from a norm of friendship based on respect. Now, the next example is the friend, let's call him Stephen, who interferes with Simon, who regularly provokes people during team meetings, even though Simon asked him to abstain. Stephen's interference, one might say, is objectionable because he treats Simon as if he's not able to guide himself, even though Simon had made it clear to him that he does not appreciate his interventions. And that seems in some sense worse in friendship. As friends, we are required to assume that we are in some sense equals and autonomous agents, which doesn't mean ideally autonomous, but autonomous in some run-of-the-mill way. So it has a distinct disrespectful meaning if we interfere with a friend against the friend's explicit will. By thereby paternalizing a friend, we thus undermine an important basis of our friendship, and it seems that such kinds of interferences are more objectionable in friendship than in relations with strangers, because we trust our friends that they respect our autonomy, and these are relationship-dependent reasons, again, against paternalism. And lastly, let's turn to the third example, where a friend, let's call him Richard, wants to interfere with his friend Laura's decision to break up with her partner. He thinks it's a big mistake and therefore declines to drive her home to see her partner and terminate the relationship. After all, the relationship seems super harmonious to him, and he thinks it's a really, really bad decision. But at the same time, he doesn't have reason to question the autonomy of Laura's decision. And it seems disrespectful to interfere because Richard entertains an unjustified belief about Laura's capacity for practical judgment. And even if he were right that Laura's decision is bad by his lights, his interference is objectionable, and again derived from a norm of friendship, because we need acknowledgement and support from our friends to exercise our autonomous capacities so as to develop and maintain self-esteem and self-trust. Richard thwarts these enabling conditions by interfering and preventing Laura from ending her relationship. If our friends treat us as if we're not competent to make important decisions about our own life, our autonomous capacities can thereby be compromised, or at least to some extent undermined, because it undermines the scaffolding conditions necessary to execute these autonomous decisions. And if it is constitutive for friendship that friends regard each other as autonomous, at least as long as they do not have very, very strong reasons to question their autonomy. And note, autonomous decisions are not equivalent to good decisions. And if that's right, we are required, in virtue of being friends, to respect and support our friends' autonomous decision. It might be super painful for us to see our friends decide in ways that we believe to be imprudent. But as long as we're friends, we maintain we are required in virtue of certain norms of friendship to nonetheless respect and potentially even support them in their autonomous decisions. I concede that all the examples remain somewhat controversial especially whether we should really support our friends in decisions we find imprudent. I find that controversial myself. But maybe we should at least, maybe we can make do with saying we should respect these autonomous decisions and abstain from talking them out of them or interfering. Also, the explanations why certain paternalistic interferences are more problematic in friendships certainly stand in need of further elaboration. But so far, I hope we have shown that paternalistic interferences can have a specific disrespectful meaning that derives from at least one norm of friendship. And there is still another dimension to the discussion that deserves mention, namely the dynamic and diachronic character of friendship. Consider again Simon, who regularly provokes other people during team meetings. He knows that his friend Stephen will interfere if he takes it too far. And Simon is one of those guys who do not reflect very much on their behavior. He knows that Stephen will step in. After several meetings, Stephen gets angry. Simon responds that he did not ask him to interfere, but Stephen responds that Simon clearly relies on him to interfere. So Simon, in some sense, as it were, regularly invites paternalism. But such patterns of invited paternalism also, it seems, undermine friendship. It contradicts the idea that friends regard each other as autonomous agents. So such patterns of, you know, ongoing invited paternalism can turn a friendship into a different kind of relationship, namely what we call some sort of therapeutic relationship, which drives out friendship and the norms that govern it, namely equality and respect for autonomy. It seems like that this can, over time, patterns of such behavior can undermine the friendly relationship, as it were. So more generally, we suggest that even minor interferences that may be individually justified can add up to problematic patterns of paternalism within friendship. And that's because ongoing patterns then carry a distinct meaning for the friendship as a whole. Now, let me now turn, so I'm almost ready, but not quite. Let me now turn to cases. Oops. What is this? Starts at the end. Let me turn to cases where paternalism actually could be considered to be more benign in friendship. Now, consider the following examples. It gets trickier and trickier, I warn you. Let's suppose Ron is a very helpful person who often too quickly offers help. These people are rare, but they exist. He is aware of this tendency and has shared his struggle with his friend Sam. Now, Sam is in a difficult situation because he needs to clean his apartment before the weekend as he is about to move out. Ron is the only friend who could probably come to help if Sam asked him to come. But as a friend, Sam decides not to do that because he knows what a hard time Ron has to say no. After the weekend, Ron learns from Sam's partner that Sam has been working all night to clean his apartment and hardly barely made it. Now, Ron approaches Sam with a slightly disappointed tone and asks him, "Why did you not ask me? I would have helped you. This is what friends are here for." Now, Sam responds, "Well, I thought it would be better for you if I did not ask. As a friend, I want you to be well, and I know that you're already overcommitted and that you have a hard time saying no." Now, Ron nods his head and says, "Thank you for caring about me." Well, we suggest that this is a simple but benign case of paternalism. Because Sam, why is that? Sam helps Ron to avoid a mistake out of concern for Ron's well-being, and he knows that Ron has a hard time avoiding that mistake. It's respectful, as Sam does not regard Ron as generally being unable to exercise his autonomous agency. Instead, His paternalism is targeted at a very specific situation and communicated as such, and does not happen very often. Instead, if Sam were regularly not to ask Ron for help anymore, his paternalism might turn into being disrespectful and undermine the relationship as one between friends. But you might think, what about more invasive cases of paternalism? Let's look at this example. I think it's the last one. William is very upset by the way his supervisor dealt with him during a meeting and decides to immediately quit his job. His friend Sarah knows that William is generally happy with his job and that he will not easily find a better one. She also knows that William can get upset quite easily. Now, when William takes his phone to call his supervisor and tell him to quit that he wants to quit the job, she takes William's phone and calmly explains, "I would never do that if I were not sure that you are out of your mind right now and will regret your decision, but I have to do that as your friend." Again, admittedly, very stylized example, but maybe it can show that even more invasive, interfering cases of paternalism can sometimes be benign and morally okay, at least in friendships. Because Sarah's interference is an act of care and concern for William's well-being, and she communicates her action in a way that makes her motivation as transparent and understandable as possible, and therefore her interference continues to remain respectful because Sarah has very good reasons for her belief that William will not be able to avoid a severe mistake in a given situation, and she says she would usually not do that. So more generally, these two examples might be able to show, you can hear the caution, that paternalistic interventions sometimes can express in very specific situations, and if so, if communicated that way, they can express both care and respect within friendships. But it also becomes clear that communication and negotiation of a shared understanding of the friendship in question will always be required when such interferences happen, otherwise they threaten to turn into disrespectful behavior. So we hope to have made plausible the idea that there is no easy solution to be had, that paternalism can be more or less problematic in friendship, that there can be relationship-dependent reasons for or against paternalism based on the competing norms of friendship, and the expressive meaning of paternalistic intervention with regard to these norms. But what remains controversial, and that's something we don't even discuss, are the specific norms of friendship one wants to subscribe to in a particular kind of friendship. On a common understanding of friendship, or widely shared understanding of friendship, we believe friends need to respect each other as agents with autonomous ends. Friends need to have sufficient care and concern for each other and trust that they both have a robust interest in their respective well-being. But the balance friends strike and the more specific norms they acknowledge may play out differently in different friendships. For that reason, paternalism in friendship cannot generally be vindicated. We believe it will never be possible to provide more than general guidelines what to look for and how to think about paternalistic intervention in a specific situation, in a particular friendship. What is benign paternalism in one friendship might not be benign at all in another friendship. Thanks very much.
Sharper understanding of paternalism.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It very much depends on what you mean by paternalism. I think we should remember that one of the patron saints of anti-paternalism is John Stuart Mill.
Mm-hmm.
But that originally in his On Liberty, he was concerned about specifically about state paternalism,
mm-hmm.
political paternalism.
That's right.
Right. So paternalism was the focal meaning was the interference of the state, and also speaking of interference, Mill made very clear that he meant forceful interference,
mm-hmm.
against your will,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And when he then goes on and says, well, I don't want this doctrine to be misunderstood, he explicitly says, and he's not even talking there about friends, he's talking about citizens, saying one misunderstanding would be to say that we should not care about each other's well-being. And he says that, on the contrary, we need, and he's talking about Victorian England, right? He fled to southern France because of the gossip about him and his beloved Harriet, right? He says there is need for a great increase of disinterested exertion to promote the good of others.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about strangers, I mean,
mm-hmm.
co-citizens, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's clearly of the opinion that indeed for the benefit of others we should interfere, and we have even a duty to interfere. But for him, extremely important is the difference between advice
mm-hmm.
that people can reject and orders that they cannot reject.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, I think we need to sharpen much more what
mm-hmm.
paternalism means there.
Mm-hmm.
He says, if I may, one more
mm-hmm.
little quote. I don't find it now. But we need, there is no limit, he says, in giving good advice,
mm-hmm.
trying to help people to find the right way. No
mm-hmm.
limit.
Mm-hmm.
Even in their private affairs,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And then one might say, well, if that holds for co-citizens, well, the more it does for my friends.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me there is a vagueness in paternalism that creates all these problems.
I see. So thanks very much. I know you have very good knowledge of Mill, so I appreciate this. I think we wanted, I mean, maybe you're right, so I think of this off the top of my head, but maybe I think we wanted to be deliberately vaguer, because there has been not quite a lot, but some discussion about the persuasion via advice is a kind of paternalistic interference that makes it psychologically, emotionally, for all kinds of reasons, very difficult to reject and does something with you. And we wanted to open this up and incorporate this idea into our notion of paternalism. And that's why, you know, I think even intuitively, we sometimes hate to receive that kind of advice that supposedly is good for us, but we don't share it at all, because advice is very tricky business. So I'm not sure I share this strong distinction between advice giving in contrast to forceful, enforced paternalistic interference. But we should think of interventions more generally, and they could be of milder forms and still be interventions in some undesired way that do something to the person who is being intervened upon. But thank you.
Thank you very much. Lots of very interesting and thought-provoking and sort of reflection-provoking how one interacts with various people in one's life. Thanks for that. I'll stick to one question initially. Concerning this the notion or the requirement that the kind of reason you're looking for, there has to be a relationship-dependent reason.
Mm-hmm.
You're interested in this, and you sort of saw sort out some of the other justifications in the first part by saying that they do give reasons for paternalism in friendship that are not, that are ultimately relationship independent.
Mm-hmm.
And your own reasons later against paternalism are meant to be relationship
independent. Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if relationship dependent independent means exactly the same thing.
Okay, good.
So when you talk about consent, for example, you said that it's not in the required sense relationship dependent because consent can be given outside of relationships. Strangers can give that and there the justification works as well, which is true, of course. But one might think that the same could be said about respect-based justifications as well. So there is... Maybe I'm wondering whether you think that there is such a special kind of respect that it's actually a different kind of respect within friendship than elsewhere, then that wouldn't be, then it would be actually relationship specific. But if not, it seems that one could say the same thing about those reasons as well, that they ultimately derive from something independent of the friendship.
Yeah, very good point, and I think we waver a bit in the paper. I think there's one part where I think it's a bit clearer that we think that the norm of respect that works in, or that matters in friendship requires us to do more than respect with humanity in general or human beings in general, namely to support each other in our autonomous decisions. Like the lifestyle alcoholic in some ways, but this is where it might get controversial, even if I think being a lifestyle alcoholic is really weird and actually a very bad idea and blah, blah, blah. If this is autonomous, which might be hard to show, you know, things are blurry and maybe you're impaired and a drunkard, but if we assume you're not impaired and you have a healthy enough mind, and I just don't think it's a good decision, but it still qualifies as an autonomous decision. We think one could plausibly make the case that there is a norm of respect operating in friendship that requires us or provides at least some reason to kind of acknowledge each other's way of life to the extent that we even support it in some sense. Doesn't necessarily involve that I buy you bottles of wine, but maybe acknowledge whatever, I don't know, comes with this outlook on life of, you know, take more interest in French wines and what comes with it and all that kind of thing. And so it comes with more positive duties than the respect in towards strangers that is also required. So that's why we think there's a difference between respect in relationships and respect. But I think I admit, and therefore I'm grateful for this, I think, and I realize we haven't made that maybe clear enough. And maybe you don't share this view anyhow, but I think that's what we're, that's the way we're, the route we're going.
To find out by themselves what their friendship is about and what do they want to talk about and how. And this room in itself is valuable. I would give reasons for that on the reasoning side. You have owned reasons and you have objective reasons. And the evaluation of these is the business of those people who are concerned. If I give advice to my friend, I can, for instance, enlarge the objectivity of his account. I can enlarge his view. I can promote his better understanding of the context with moral advice, with logical advice, whatever it is. I can help to better state the problem. This is my role as a friend. How it takes place, what is the wording, in which context, there are as many possibilities as there are human beings or friendships. On the other side, if I account for the ownership of normative choices, that means I leave sufficient latitude, sufficient room for individual decision making.
Mm-hmm.
So if I give advice on the to enlarge the objectivity of the decision, the autonomous decision, and in turn I leave sufficient latitude that the friend makes up his own mind based on my arguments and reaches an own conclusion,
mm-hmm.
then there is no interference,
mm-hmm.
there is no paternalism
mm-hmm.
at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I think I agree with this, what you said at the end. And I think that's up our alley, because what we believe is that it depends a hell lot on how you negotiate in a relationship, that the what we call the competing norms of friendship are jointly realized, namely show care and concern and be respectful. And so it takes a lot of negotiation and communication. It takes a certain ethics of communication to make clear, you know, look, this is I don't mean to, and we sometimes do that. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but maybe you want to look at other, you know, it depends on how we do that.
Is there a general kind of a revelation of universal wisdom, kind of a recipe? I don't think so. Take the alcoholic, for example.
On this very general level, I think it is. There are certain guidelines what to think about and how to navigate it. But how people do that individually, you know, on the ground is a different business. And there might be different understandings and different weights we assign to these norms. But I don't think friendship is entirely up to our individual interpretation. So if you lead an abusive relationship in some sense, where you're the inferior and the other is clearly somebody dictating you what you should be doing, I think we have good reasons to criticize this as not qualifying as a friendship. But there is, I agree, some latitude how we interpret and shape this friendship. And it is still okay to call this a friendship. But there are some general norms I think we can come up with. They're certainly context-dependent and culture-dependent and what have you, so it gets blurry and tricky, as always, when we do ethics. But I think something can be said, and at least in our world, I think we do agree that some sort of equality, some sort of symmetry, and some sort of respect for autonomy on some very basic level is what it takes to qualify a relationship as being one of friendship. But then how you navigate the care and concern and the respect, you know, there are different ways to do that, and different friends might do that differently and understand the interventions differently. So on that level of particularity, I agree, there might be a hell lot of differences, but they can be captured jointly on this a bit more general level, we believe.
So I don't think my intuition changed on what I'm about to say. Maybe I'm just confused.
Mm-hmm.
But on the topic of beneficence,
mm-hmm.
Something that did come up is that friendships do differ from the doctor-patient relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's there because you're friends.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps, and I'm not sure about this, but perhaps the friend who is about to make a bad decision imposes some sort of suffering on the potentially helping friend,
mm-hmm.
You know, because they have to look on helplessly otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because they impose that suffering, this other friend is entitled to some level of paternalism.
Mm-hmm.
But
interesting.
Not self-regarding, because that friend just wants to help his friend. The right stems from the imposing of the suffering, and it's also not consent, though, because the friend who's about to do something stupid might not actually want to give this other friend the right to help, but they automatically do, perhaps.
Okay, so the point is, I'm just trying to make sense of it, that it sounds interesting. So your point is, there's a difference in beneficence, and it might be compared to the doctor-patient relationship that we might be more that it might be less morally problematic to be paternalistic in friendships, because when we cater to the well-being of the friend for the friend's sake, there is suffering involved, and the doctor doesn't suffer on behalf of their patients if the patients make mistakes and decide against the surgery or something. Whereas in friendship, we do suffer on behalf of our friends. And what derives from that? If that is true, I'm not fully sure.
So the higher suffering maybe comes from the unity that came up in the other view. Like we are connected, we are meshed in some sense. Mm-hmm. And that's why we kind of suffer more if something bad is going to happen to them. And perhaps, like, these things are not entangled. Like, because I suffer, mm-hmm. because they're about to do something stupid, I kind of get the right to be paternalistic. But it doesn't have anything to do with it being self-regarding. I'm not going to help them to ease my own suffering. I'm going to help them for their own sake. But my right to help them stems from the fact that...
But couldn't one say that the suffering, again, gives you only more better epistemic access to their well-being and whatever is involved in their well-being? If the suffering is other-directed to the lower level of well-being of the friend, doesn't that then not only track the friend's well-being in some sense better or more than it does in other kinds of relations?
So your point is that it is, in a sense, relationship independent.
Yeah. I mean, I'm saying that off the top of my head. I will think about this case, so thank you for raising it. But I'm just trying to make sense of what normative roles the suffering can play. That could justify paternalism, sorry.
Yeah, I wonder whether there's like a hard cutoff between what is relationship independent, mm-hmm. and what is dependent. It seems like there's a sliding scale, right? Like,
okay.
The more friends mm-hmm. are, mm-hmm. the more like this suffering is going to motivate me. A very empathic doctor might, of course, also.
Right, I was thinking of that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But it does seem like because they don't experience that unity with this other friend, like mm-hmm. in the sense we are meshed, mm-hmm. they are.
Which is other, and it is other directed.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm not, as I said, I have a tendency to think that's relationship independent, but you still said something very interesting, and you might be right that there is a sliding scale between relationship independent and dependent considerations. Again, things are blurry, but what matters to us that we can keep them separate in some very typical cases, and still concede that there might be blurry cases, which are just very difficult to interpret. And we should add that. But I think there are huge continua where, you know, the distinction is pretty clear. But thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Monica. It was very interesting. I think we've shown that it's very complicated. Mm-hmm. Because you were thinking about sort of examples, and basically it's this kind of Popperian thing. I mean, if there's a general principle and people claim, okay, you know, in friendship it's all the way around, then you come up with a counterexample. And okay, I mean, I take that for granted, I think it works. But the question is, I mean, couldn't you think at the level of sort of general trends to capture a little bit of what's happening at the level of friendship? Because it seems to me that some of these approaches sort of are right in certain trends. I mean, some things are different in a friendship and they have an influence on paternalism. And one trend might just be that you know better what your friend likes and these kind of things. And I think this knowledge condition makes a huge difference in many examples. For instance, in the example with Anne with this lifestyle alcoholic, if she has told me several times and I know it really, it makes a difference here. So knowledge is one thing. Mm-hmm. And then another trend, I think, is that respect is less of an issue in some sense, because respect is often to do with the idea that other people do things and like things that I don't really like. I mean, you know, I mean, there's the colleague, and the colleague always introduces her questions with a quote from Hegel, and I don't like it, but I have to respect it, right? But this kind of thing doesn't happen in friendship because we have more shared approach.
mm-hmm.
that sort of turn on the nature of friendship, and whether that would be a sort of approach that could help. I mean, these trends are not sort of clear, strict principles.
Mm-hmm.
You can falsify them with the example, but still, I mean, these trends help you to think about the issue.
Okay, thanks. I think what you call trends is something we call norms of friendship? Or is it something different that you have in mind?
They're not strict. I think it's a bit lower. I mean, if it's at the level of norms, I think I get into the kinds of considerations that you have brought forward.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit bigger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, I guess I have to think about whether a weaker notion of norm.
And sometimes it's not even normative. I mean, we know more about trends, right? I mean, that's just an observation. But maybe you can use that mm-hmm. sort of trend to explain what goes on.
But I think, it could also be problematic to talk about trends and equalize different kinds of considerations that matter when it comes to paternalism and friendship, because when we talked about what you call the knowledge condition, that we have usually a better epistemic access to our friend, our claim was that is a relationship-independent consideration, because you know we can think about hypothetical scenarios where we overhear something about some other person, thereby having better epistemic access to what's going on, and that grounds a reason to interfere. And so it's not the relationship that does the normative work. So that's why we had this big issue with epistemic access. But it also holds true, and that's your thing with trends, that typically, of course, we have better epistemic access to the vulnerabilities of our friends. But this is not what explains or justifies paternalism and friendship. So that was the argumentative move. Sure.
I was wondering, and I was always taught that way as well, but now listening to you, I was thinking, do we need relationship-independent considerations to the extent that you mm-hmm. believe we need them? And I was thinking about cases of the consent case. If you take that, I mean, this is a claim in itself, and you might question that we actually consent to anything alike in friendships. But let's assume we do, then it might be true that among strangers, if they consent, paternalism is sometimes not as bad or worse or whatever
sure.
direction it takes.
Sure.
So if we take it that friends always consent to whatever, some kind of paternalistic action, mm-hmm. then it's not a kind of strictly friendship-dependent consideration. Nevertheless, it explains why friendship is always making mm-hmm. having impact on kind of paternal on the evaluation or the
mm-hmm.
stages of paternalistic acts, and it might happen that in some other cases the same effect takes place as well. So why is that mm-hmm. problematic? Because we'd not compare, and I'm a little bit surprised at this question mm-hmm. coming from myself, but now I was thinking in particular with regards to cases like consent, I would say, yeah, this is probably exactly... I mean, I'm not believing that we consent, but if you assume it, then I'd say it's probably giving a pretty good picture
mm-hmm.
as to why and what cases might be wrong. I mean, friends always consent, then it might not be paternalistic anymore, but I mean, if you want to include it. And then I agree that other cases where people consent, it's not as bad either. So I was wondering, mm-hmm. why in this strict sense... if you take this explanation, it needs to be relationship dependent in order to give a good explanation as to what happens and how we deal with cases of paternalism in their deontic status.
Well, I guess, again, using Klaus's word trend, maybe there is a trend. I'm not even sure about this, but maybe one could say that there is a trend that friends are more at ease, that they paternalize each other. I'm not sure, but maybe it's true, or maybe some people think it's true, but it certainly doesn't hold generally for friendships.
totally agree there, but right. This doesn't seem to be your point about it's not friendship, it's not relation. The counter-argument on your side was, we can't, this is not the right explanation because it's not friendship independent, friendship dependent.
Right.
And I would fully agree, I don't agree with this, that it's a good explanation because I simply think friends do not consent to any behavior like this and not certainly not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
I was just responding to your response because I think the response, this is a friend, this is a relationship independent consideration.
Mm-hmm.
It's not enough to say we can't use it. So I'm not saying this is the right explanation. I'm just saying the response you gave doesn't fully convince
you. Oh yeah, yeah. I'm just trying to understand. So you mean when friends give consent to paternalistic interference, and paternalism is okay, and it is as okay in friendship as in any other kind of relation where somebody gives their consent to paternalistic interference, right?
No, I took the explanation responded to be that friendship always consent by being friends to some kind of paternalistic.
Not always. That's one way to interpret it. And then we say, if that's a valid, if we want to interpret it that way, that doesn't provide us with a good reason that paternalism is justified in friendship in a different way than it is generally, namely in virtue of consent being given.
This is exactly the point where my question is directed at.
Mm-hmm.
So you say, let's read this that way. Mm-hmm. They mean friends always consent, and this explains why paternalism in friendship is not as bad. And then your response is, oh, but this explanation doesn't work because it's a friendship-independent consideration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my question is, do we really need the friendship-independent...
Dependent.
...friendship-dependent consideration in order to get rid of this argument? Because it might just be such that always in friendship,
mm-hmm.
provided they always consent, that makes paternalism better. And then there might be other cases
where
strangers consent and they're actually paternalism isn't as bad. And this seems to be could be exactly how the world is like.
Well,
so I'm wondering whether the response we needed...
Uh-huh. Well, I guess I guess this is because there is this debate on paternalism is more benign in friendships against which we direct our arguments. Otherwise, it would not be an interesting discussion if we said, well, you know, sometimes when consent is being given, you know, paternalism is justified. It's not pretend to wrong. It's okay. And that holds true either in friendships or in other relationships. The relation the two parties stand with regard to each other doesn't play any interesting role. And the debate is about whether this kind of relationship does play an interesting role with regard to the deontic status of paternalism. And if it hinges on consent, it's not the relationship that changes the deontic status, but the consent that's been given. And that holds true for any kind of relation, independent of any thick relationship the parties stand with regard to each other. So that was sort of the point of departure. And the dialectic of our argument. Of course, you could say, well, you know, sometimes people consent, and then paternalism is fine, and that holds true in friendship and holds true in other kinds of relations. I mean, yeah, that's true. It just doesn't show us what these people want us to believe, namely that the relationship in which two parties stand that paternalize each other does play a role with regard to paternalism and its justification. Am I being clear?
Or I'd say
maybe I don't get what you mean. Maybe Andreas can help us.
Part of what I also had, you said that if that's the justification people give, then the relationship does not really play a role, the friendship relationship does not really play a role in explaining why paternalism is benign. What really plays the role is the consent. But couldn't those people respond, well, so there is a sense in which the relationship does play a role, because the relationship explains and is sufficient for explaining why consent is present.
Mm-hmm.
In other cases, we have to sort of, it's contingent whether consent is present between strangers.
Mm-hmm.
But if this sort of controversial regard of friendship is true and such that friendship
mm-hmm.
entails mm-hmm. consent, then it's, in a sense,
okay.
in a sense you're right, it's still not the friendship that is doing the justificatory work, it's the consent. But the friendship is doing some work because it entails that this
consent.
Other
justification. Okay, interesting answer. But if it's necessary, I mean, I wouldn't agree that this is necessarily the case, that friendship entails consent to paternalism. That would be a much too substantive conception of friendship, and that turns the whole debate into a question-begging enterprise, because we built in paternalism and its justification into our understanding of friendship, and this is what we did not want.
But then, I mean,
you know what I mean?
That's part of the response you also gave in the paper, and that I think I find convincing. But you also, so you gave another response, and that response was, this can't be a good justification
mm-hmm.
because the type of justification, consent-based, is also available outside of friendship. And that seems to be a different mm-hmm. point.
Okay.
The point that if, mm-hmm. If you're building the justification, mm-hmm. the connection to the justification into the concept of friendship,
mm-hmm.
then it's a question begging.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so great, good. So that means there are two dimensions. One is the relationship independent thing with consent, and the other one is the question begging inbuilding of consent into friendship. I think I can disentangle this and make that more precise. That's helpful.
And there's a third one that is not the concept of friendship.
Sorry?
And there's a third one that you mentioned as well, that it's not a convincing conception of friendship to start with,
mm-hmm.
that they always necessarily...
Absolutely. So the question-begging thing, and, you know, we want a rather loose conception of friendship, because otherwise we run the risk of building stuff in to get something out of this, right? Did you have a follow-up?
No.
Can you speak up?
Yes, intuitively, I would say that friendships contain the assignment to help reflect own actions, no matter if they are good or bad. So in a way, when we enter into a friendship, we decide autonomously to give our friend the assignment to help us reflect bad decisions or actions,
mm-hmm.
also in a paternalistic way.
Mm-hmm. Assignment was the word. Okay. So your claim is, if I'm correct, that, and you correct me if I'm not correct, that friendship, it's constitutive for friendship that we want our friends to correct us in certain ways when we risk to go astray in our decisions. But again, I mean, that goes back to the previous discussion. In a way, that's a very contested conception of friendship, and I wouldn't want to hold on to such a substantive conception of friendship, because I'm sure when we take a vote, there might be quite a few people who wouldn't subscribe to this view of friendship. And again, it could be question begging if this means being paternalistic. I mean, whatever correcting precisely means, but, you know, sounds pretty paternalistic to me. Then we built paternalism into our notion of friendship. That's not the way we can justify it. It would be quite a question-begging maneuver. So that would be my answer to this strategy.
Maybe
does that make sense to you?
Yes, absolutely. Maybe I can add something.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure it's really difficult to put it in words, but yes, there are different friendships, also for me, when I think about my friends. I have friends where it's better or would be more painful to say paternalistic things, and there are also other friends where it's not at the same level.
I mean, I agree, and I think that's compatible with our view, that in different kinds of friendship, we negotiate how we cater to the norms governing friendship differently. So some friendships might be more caring and supportive in your sense, and others others find it super important in their friendships to be very respectful and not interfering, and there are various ways to navigate it. It's interesting that you point that out, because it is true that the philosophical debate on friendship has always turned on a very idealized conception of friendship and the value of friendship. And I think I agree, and there's actually a very recent paper by Simon Keller on that, that we lead very different kinds of relationships and very different kinds of friendships, and not all of them are ideal, and we navigate our friendships differently in different kinds of friendships. So I think we make room for this while still holding on to some sort of general trends or guidelines, what norms have to be fulfilled in some sense, while allowing for some latitude to qualify as friendship. And that would speak to your idea that some might be more caring in a more interfering way, but still be respectful. But it can only go to a certain extent, and otherwise it would threaten to undermine the friendship. And I know some people like messiness and others hate it, and we try to steer a middle course.
There's more people on the list, but it's 7:45 and we have to finish. But I'd like to thank you very much for this talk, and the fact that there's more people wanting to ask questions shows how thought-provoking it was. So thank you very much.
Thank you. That was really helpful and very stimulating. Thanks very much for your questions and the feedback, and I'm sure it will help us revise our paper. So at least you have some impact, and so thanks very much. I really appreciated it.